Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners. And there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Most of us can't understand what it means to be truly wealthy. There's a reason it's called the 1%. A peek behind the curtain to those unicorns who are born into the privilege and glamour of the uber-rich is often irresistible. Ben Novak, his wife Bernice, and their son Ben Jr., known in childhood as Benji, encapsulated everything about the rich and famous in the 1960s. Ben Sr. built the infamous Fontainebleau Hotel on the strip of Miami Beach in 1954. Ben and Bernice Novak were held as the king and queen of Miami Beach, and Benji came up the lonely prince in the tower, living on the 17th floor. Waited on hand and foot, his every whim granted, Ben Novak Jr.'s only friends were really employees. This colored his adult life in many ways. He had trouble making and maintaining intimate relationships, but he was a brilliant, if cold, businessman. The saga of the Miami Beach Novak family ends in the bankruptcy of the Fontainebleau and two brutal murders. Scandals which captivated the nation, spurning lawsuits which are still winding their way through probate court. Welcome to Episode 57, Miami Beach Royalty, The Novak Murders, Part 1. Miami Beach is a coastal resort city and an island city in South Florida. It is located on natural and man-made barrier islands between the Atlantic Ocean and Biscayne Bay. Biscayne Bay separates Miami Beach from the mainland city of Miami, though the island is connected to the mainland by the Venetian Causeway Bridge. The wide and beautiful white beaches span from North Shore Open Space Park, past the palm-lined Loomis Park, to South Point Park, lining the shimmering turquoise-colored waters of the Atlantic. Miami Beach is known as an LGBT mecca, with pride events drawing over 13,000 visitors annually. In January of 2010, Miami Beach passed a revised human rights ordinance that strengthened existing laws and added additional protections for transgender people, making Miami Beach's human rights laws some of the most progressive in the state. On the far southern end, South Beach, or SoBe as it's known, has its own distinct personality. From the Art Deco Historic District, with pastel-colored mansions, to its hundreds of nightclubs, restaurants, hotels, and boutiques, South Beach is also infamous for the murder of Johnny Versace, who was shot to death on the front steps of his home on Ocean Drive in South Beach in 1997. It is also the setting for several movies, like Scarface and The Birdcage, and the 1980s show Miami Vice. The town of Miami Beach was chartered in 1915 and became a city in 1917. By the 1920s, it had become a haven for wealthy snowbirds from the North and Midwest who built winter homes there. That's when the building of the grand hotels really began, with the Flamingo Hotel, the Fleetwood, and the Nautilus among them. And by 1941, while the rest of America was recovering from the Great Depression, it remained a retreat for the rich and famous, with even the Duke and Duchess of Windsor vacationing there after his scandalous abdication of the throne. That's the year that Ben Novak and his wife Bella moved to Miami Beach. Ben Novak was from New York and had helped run his family's hotel in the Catskills. He had liquidated a clothing store he and his wife had owned, which was failing in the Depression-era economy, and set his sights on the ultimate Babylon, as Miami Beach had been dubbed by a New York Tribune columnist. He sunk everything he had into an 11-room hotel on 30th Street, with his wife working as a chambermaid. It was rough going for a while, until the Second World War broke out, which, as author John Glatt wrote, made Ben Novak rich beyond his wildest dreams. The Army took over Miami Beach in February of 1942, taking advantage of the ideal weather conditions for basic training. 100,000 soldiers from the Army Air Corps and the Navy took over Miami Beach, and the U.S. government paid hotel owners well for the accommodations. The government paid up to $10 a night per room to house the soldiers, not including food. That's about $150 today. Within 5 years, Ben Novak Sr. had bought up 5 other hotels. Ben Novak Sr. was a bit of a dandy. He was handsome, if a compact man, who loved to dress flamboyantly. He was also a womanizer, often cheating on Bella. But when he met a 21-year-old model named Bernice Stemple in a nightclub in Manhattan, he was determined to marry her. Bernice was gorgeous, with red hair, blue eyes, and an enviable figure. Though it was love at first sight for Ben, it wasn't for Bernice. He was 38 years old, married, wore a hearing aid, and was too flashy. Bernice was also married, and her husband was still fighting in Europe. But Ben wasn't giving up. He asked her out repeatedly, tried to get her number from friends, and eventually set up a fake photo shoot in Havana to lure her. She showed up with another model from her agency and was surprised to see Ben Novak there. But Bernice was impressed. His romantic subterfuge had worked, and it kicked off a stormy 4-year relationship before the two finally married in 1952 in New York City. Though Bernice by then had great success as a model, she was even the face of Coca-Cola, she had agreed to give up her career and move to Miami Beach with Ben. Ben had promptly divorced Bella and abandoned their 2-year-old son they had adopted, named Ronald, when Bernice accepted his proposal. Bernice had come from a strained home life. Her parents divorced when she was still a child in the 1930s, and though her father waged a bitter custody battle with her mother, he did not spend time with her or her sister Maxine. The girls were even sent to an orphanage while their father continued to deny their mother any contact with them. I think Bernice's isolated childhood influenced her later as a mother. She had difficulty connecting with her young son, though later in life the two would be very close. That closeness would lead to their deaths. I'm going to pause now for a quick commercial break.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Newly married Bernice Novak came to Miami Beach and lived in the Sansucci Hotel with her husband. Ben owned it with his partner, Harry Muffson. It was the first luxury hotel that Novak built, but he still had bigger dreams. He wanted to buy up an old crumbling estate that boasted 950 feet of unadulterated oceanfront views. He wanted to build the largest hotel in Miami Beach. In 1951, Ben and his partner Harry Muffson managed to buy the estate for $2.3 million. That would be about $23 million today. They planned a 550-room grand hotel costing $10 million to build, $100 million in 2019 dollars. But Muffson found out that Ben Novak had cheated him out of $15,000 on the Sensucci, and then that Novak had only had his name put on the new deed. Muffson backed out and got a lawyer, leaving Novak 24 hours to come up with partners to finish the deal. He managed to do it. One of the partners who put up the most money was none other than infamous mafia boss Sam Giancana, and he would not remain a silent partner. Once the deal went through, Ben Novak hired a young architect named Morris Lapidus. Novak had wanted a name, and Morris Lapidus was trying to make a name for himself. He agreed to take on the project for a paltry $80,000, with the condition that he had complete design control. He even wanted to pick out the bellhop's uniforms. Even though he was given the impossible deadline of 1 year until opening, Lapidus took the gig and moved his wife and kids to Miami Beach. He immediately set out to design a building uniquely different from other hotels. Lapidus sketched out a curved building, something he had done before in his New York department stores. "A sweeping, curved building is what I wanted," he would later say. Reportedly, when he showed the plans to his client, Ben Novak tore up the drawings in a rage and threw them in the trash, saying he would dream up his own shape. Just a few days later, he called Lapidus and said that he had his own brilliant idea. "Why not have a curved building?" he said. No one had ever designed a curved building. This kicked off a battle that would go on for decades, even after both men were dead. Lapidus insisted he came up with the design first, and Novak said he came up with the idea on the toilet, a claim Bernice Novak would back up until her death. Morris Lapidus swallowed his pride. He needed this job to propel him into the big leagues. But 6 months into the project, in June of 1954, he had already gone through the $80,000 fee. He told Novak he was quitting unless he got $75,000 more. Novak promised him the extra money upon completion, and Lapidus agreed, not wanting to ruin his reputation by walking away from the biggest project of his career. Situated on oceanfront Collins Avenue in the heart of what is now Millionaire's Row, the Fountain Blue became the most majestic and impressive hotel on Miami Beach. The iconic crescent-shaped building is unmatched in design and still holds an impressive place in Miami Beach history. The grand opening was held on December 20, 1954, with even the mayor of New York City being flown in for the ball that was held for 1,600 celebrity guests. The guest of honor was the mayor of Fontainebleau, France, Homer Peugeot. You may have noticed that the hotel took on an anglicized pronunciation of its namesake, a commune in Paris. This was something that aggravated Bernice Novak, who often corrected friends who didn't use the French pronunciation. But it was done. The hotel would forever be the Fountain Blue to locals. I've heard it pronounced many different ways, and Googling French pronunciations made it even more confusing. So from here on out, I'll refer to it as the Fountain Blue. That is the way Ben Novak said it, and that's what became the norm. The lavish hotel was unlike any other luxury hotel, with two nightclubs, several restaurants, a spa, several pools, including an Olympic-sized lap pool, and a freeform pool in a loose bow tie design that faced the ocean, even with millionaires and celebrities like Groucho Marx lining up to be seen at the Blue. The hotel wasn't without its critics. Some architects called it a monstrosity. If anything, that only made Ben Novak prouder, as he deemed his beloved Fountain Blue the world's most pretentious hotel. The interior was elegantly styled with French influences, white marble floors, antiques, and statues. In the hotel's main interior was the famed Staircase to Nowhere that Morris Lapidus had copied from the Paris Opera House. While Novak certainly courted celebrities, it was the influence of mob boss Sam Giancana that got Frank Sinatra to start playing the hotel. In exchange for his own permanent penthouse suite, Sinatra began playing midnight shows in the La Ronda Room nightclub. For 25 years, Sinatra would be a stalwart at the hotel, bringing in the Rat Pack and other celebrities with him. Judy Garland, Marlena Dietrich, Gary Cooper, and Joan Crawford. It's a who's who of movie stars in the 50s. And Ben Novak meant for the Fountain Blue to feel exclusive. During his ownership of the hotel, there was never a Fountain Blue sign in or outside the hotel. The iconic building spoke for itself. It didn't need a sign. Ben and Bernice moved into a duplex suite on the 17th floor. The four-bedroom apartment had ocean views with a dining room, billiard room, and a piano bar. It was into this opulence that Ben Novak Jr. was born in 1956. Bernice had long resigned herself to second after the hotel in her husband's affections. He lived, ate, and breathed the hotel and worked almost 24/7. She told author Stephen Gaines that the Fountain Blue was, quote, his baby, his wife, his mistress, all his dreams and ideas together. Bernice spent her days shopping, dressing herself in the latest designer clothes, befitting a trophy wife to the famous hotelier. Ben Jr., or Benji as he was called as a child, moved into the 17th floor with his parents. He had a live-in wet nurse as a baby and a series of nannies throughout his childhood who took care of him. Ben and Bernice were readily available for lavish birthday parties and photo shoots, but other than that, they were the epitome of the absentee parents. The year Benji was born, Ben Novak got into another fight with architect Morris Lapidus. He was designing the Eden Rock Hotel, right across from the Fountain Blue on Collins Avenue. Novak secretly bought up parking space between the two hotels and soon began building a 17-story concrete wall, designed to block the sunlight to the Eden Rock swimming pool. Suffice it to say, Ben Novak was extremely petty and vindictive. He and Lapidus had maintained a strained relationship right through the opening of Fountain Blue, when in front of investors, Lapidus asked for the rest of his fee, the agreed-upon $75,000. When Novak acted like he didn't know what he was talking about, Lapidus became enraged and tried to attack him. It took several of the business partners to pull him off of Ben Novak. Novak insisted on an apology before he would pay the man his fee, and thereafter, Lapidus was not welcome in the incredible hotel he had designed. Maitre d's and managers had orders to throw him out on sight, so he did have his own reasons for wanting to design a hotel next door to his masterpiece. He just somehow underestimated Novak's vindictiveness. The media called Novak's creation the Spite Wall, and the two hotels wound up in court over it. In 1959, the Florida District Court of Appeals rejected Eden Rock's claim to an easement allowing sunlight, and the new hotel was forced to build a second swimming pool for guests to have full access to the sun. From start to finish, the Fountain Blue would remain wrapped in one scandal after another. Between Ben Novak Sr.'s many public feuds, the presence of mafia bosses and celebrities behaving badly, the public swarmed to the hotel, dying to see the rich and famous and be a part of history. It is said that Frank Sinatra set up Marilyn Monroe with John F. Kennedy in one of the Fountain Blue rooms. The FBI kept a tight watch on the hotel, as well as the IRS. The Fountain Blue was mobbed up as much as it was a place that celebrities flocked to. Sinatra and his friends often ended nights throwing cherry bombs off their balconies, after calling downstairs to the Poodle Lounge for buckets of champagne and the prettiest girls to be sent up. And it was in this decadence that baby Benji grew up. He had a strict German nanny who forced the left-handed boy to write with his right hand. He developed a severe stutter under her strict tutelage. People noticed that even when other kids were around, Benji had no interest in playing with them. He didn't know how to be a kid. He was always around adults. And what's more, he became used to ordering them around. His tantrums were monumental. Benji's Aunt Maxine, Bernice's sister, spoke with author John Glatt extensively about Ben Jr.'s childhood. Quote, when he wanted his parents, he couldn't just go down and call for them. They were with presidents, diplomats, Sinatra, and the rest. He was this little king, but this poor kid didn't get any love. The summer Benji was 7 years old, a film crew took over the huge Fountain Blue swimming pool to film scenes for the new James Bond movie, Goldfinger. He got to meet Sean Connery, among many actors and celebrities. The little prince of Fountain Blue pretty much ran wild at the hotel. He befriended security guards and waiters who felt sorry for him. Making matters worse, the strained union between his parents was becoming more obvious. Ever the womanizer, Ben Sr. didn't stop his many affairs, and Bernice, in turn, began several affairs with Latin musicians who played at the hotel. But as with many womanizing tyrants, Ben Novak Sr. would cheat, but he wouldn't put up with it from his wife. He had one musician beaten and thrown out of the hotel, and by August of 1964, blind items were running in local gossip columns about a prominent hotelier and his wife having marital issues. In October, Bernice filed for divorce, charging Ben Novak Sr. with cruelty and going for custody of Benji. But she moved out of the Fountain Blue, leaving Benji with his absent father. and then Ben Sr. had a change of heart and did everything he could to win his wife back. Maybe he realized she was an asset he couldn't afford to lose. Maybe he really loved her. There are many indications towards the end of both of their lives that they did indeed have deep love for each other. But Ben also needed Bernice. She was in many ways the glamorous face of the hotel. By July of 1965, she dropped divorce proceedings and moved back into the hotel. But almost immediately, Bernice began an affair with a Latin drummer named George Rodriguez. Ben got suspicious and had her followed. And this time, he filed for divorce himself. Naturally, Bernice said that Ben was also having an affair this whole time, but it didn't matter. Ben Sr. filed for divorce on January 15, 1966, just 4 days before Benji's 10th birthday. He charged infidelity, mental anguish, and said that Bernice had stolen from him, and she was a bad mother. He sued for full custody of Benji. Bernice countersued, saying that Ben Sr. was a verbally abusive alcoholic. During their bitter divorce, Benji just ran wild. If he had been a spoiled handful before, now he was incorrigible. But the hotel staff felt sorry for him. They knew they were his only friends, that the Fontainebleau was his only family. In January of 1966, the television show Batman premiered, and 10-year-old Ben Novak Jr. became obsessed. As an adult, he would come to own the second-largest Batman memorabilia collection in the world. He even commissioned his own Batmobile. You've got to wonder if he felt a connection to the lonely rich kid, Bruce Wayne. He also became enamored with police officers and detectives. He had always been friendly with security at the Fontainebleau, but now he latched on to the many police officers who were always hanging around the bars and restaurants in the hotel. Ben Sr. always let cops eat for free, probably hoping they would look the other way in some of his dealings, but he was indeed generous to the Miami Beach police. But by then, the mafia had pretty much taken over the Fontainebleau. Author John Glatt reported that the mob paid Ben Novak Sr. $2 million a year to be their frontman at Fontainebleau. Ironically, at the same time, Sin City was burgeoning in the Nevada desert. Las Vegas had one thing Miami Beach couldn't offer: gambling. Ben Sr. spoke confidently to the press, blowing off any concerns of competition from Vegas or the Caribbean islands, which were fast becoming a popular tourist destination. Naturally, the islands also allowed gambling, but when Ben Sr. applied for a permit to build a hotel on one of the Cat Cay Islands, he was turned down by the Royal Commission. His reputation was catching up to him. In January of 1967, the Miami Herald ran investigative articles by two reporters who had spent months examining the hotel's financial records. The front page articles went national, with the headlines screaming the hotel was a front for gamblers and hoodlums. Specifically, that Novak was connected to Meyer Lansky as well as Sam Giancana. Of course, Ben Novak sued the Miami Herald, and in response, the Herald subpoenaed Frank Sinatra to testify to the mafia's involvement in the Fontainebleau. Sinatra lied under oath, denying everything. He canceled performances that February, but soon started up again until the Herald again subpoenaed him that April. This time he left town to avoid testifying. He could not be extradited back to Florida, but he would be arrested the minute he put a toe over the state line. On April 20, 1968, Ben Novak dropped his libel suit against the Miami Herald in exchange for a front-page statement that he was the sole owner of the Fontainebleau's operating company. But the paper didn't apologize or print a retraction of the mob accusations. Author John Glatt said the rumors were that Sinatra strong-armed Novak into dropping the suit so he could return to Miami Beach without risk of being jailed. Then suddenly, on June 3rd, Bernice Novak agreed to settle their divorce out of court. She returned the items Ben Novak Sr. claimed she had stolen, and she was no longer seeking custody of Benji. It was rumored that she got $25,000 a year in alimony. That would be almost $184,000 in 2019 money. And though she had taken a different suite at the Fontainebleau, she now moved out of her home for the last 14 years and bought a mansion in Fort Lauderdale. Despite winning custody, Ben Sr. allowed Benji to move in with his mother in the fall of 1968 when he was 12 years old. He was enrolled in a private school that he was chauffeured to daily. While at school, he became interested in theater, specifically sound and light design, and he made a friend, one he would keep until his death, the actor Kelsey Grammer. Kelsey's parents had divorced when he was young, but he was sent to private school just a few months after his father had been murdered in the Virgin Islands. The two lonely boys had a lot in common. Ben Jr.'s dad, now 62 years old, had remarried to a 22-year-old model. He had little time for his son when he came to visit, and teenaged Benji, who now preferred to be called Ben, became even more of a tyrant at the hotel. Ben Jr. notoriously fired a chef who was busy preparing the evening meal for a huge party for not stopping and making him a bowl of ice cream. When the chef went to Ben Sr. about his son's behavior, Novak told him to get the hell out. It would set a dangerous precedent. Ben Jr. had complete control, and it was also teaching him to be a cold, calculating businessman. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from our sponsors. We all know some things are good for our skin and other things are not, but did you know there are over 64 skincare mistakes most of us are making? You can seriously be harming your skin and not know it. I've done it myself, like when I've only remembered to wear SPF on sunny days. That's why I was so excited when I found Beauty by Design. Beauty by Design gives you a completely personalized skincare routine, providing everyday guidance from experts. Beauty by Design connects you with a live esthetician who you can text for free for life. Everything is personalized to your needs, with options for different price points. The process is simple and convenient. In under 2 minutes, I answered a few questions about my skin, sent a selfie, and then I had a short consultation with my esthetician and got personalized product recommendations. You only order the products you need when you need them, and shipping and returns are always free. My personalized regimen has helped clear up my oily skin while still being able to moisturize without worrying about breakouts. Go to beautybydesign.com/southernfried and use the promo code Southern Fried. First-time customers get 20% off. That's promo code Southern Fried at beautybydesign.com/southernfried for 20% off. Green Chef is a USDA certified organic company that makes eating well easy and affordable with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle. Green Chef lets you choose from easy to follow recipes with a wide variety of organic ingredients. The recipes include pre-made and measured sauces, dressings, and spices so you can get more flavor without spending a fortune stocking your spice cabinet. Meal plans include paleo, plant-powered vegan and vegetarian, pescatarian, keto, gluten-free, and omnivore. My husband and I have been following the keto diet plan, and Green Chef has made planning meals so much more fun. Left to my own devices, I would cook the same meals over and over. Instead, with Green Chef, I get to try something new with every box. And I love that Green Chef does the meal planning, grocery shopping, and handpicks the ingredients, and delivers it all right to my door. It's making achieving my 2019 health goals that much easier. My favorite recipe out of my latest Green Chef delivery is the Memphis-style barbecue chicken with Parmesan green beans and basil vinaigrette slaw. Southern Fried listeners, I have a special offer for you. For a total of $75 off, that's $25 off each of your first three boxes, go to greenchef.us/southernfried75. Once again, to get a total of $75 off your first three boxes, just go to greenchef.us/southernfried75. As Ben Jr. was going through his teen years, awkward, stuttering, and yet commanding, his father was still trying to expand his empire. In 1970, Ben Sr. bought the Sorrento Hotel, just down the road from the Fontainebleau. During construction, on a new wing, the entire building collapsed, and Ben Sr. was liable for repairs. But after all the negative publicity of being associated with mobsters, he was unable to get outside financing. He took $3 million from the Fontainebleau's cash to finish the project. A year after that, he bought more land with a new hotel in mind. But again, he could not get legitimate investors with his ties to the mob. So he refinanced the Fontainebleau, taking out a $6 million mortgage. This was the beginning of the downfall for Ben Sr. financially. The golden days were over. But he did still have a few years left as king of the Fontainebleau. In June of 1970, he put Ben Jr. on the Fontainebleau payroll, working security for $25 a day. It was 6 months before his 15th birthday. By the time he turned 15, he was going on regular patrols with the Miami Beach Police. Retired Miami Beach Detective Joe Matthews spoke to author John Glatt, explaining that this wasn't, quote, a privilege granted to the average kid. But Ben Sr. still held great influence and stayed tight with the police, despite his reputation and connections to the mob. December of 1971 brought Ben Sr. his third divorce. She had fallen in love with another rich, successful man. Ben Sr. would later say that none of his marriages worked because he was married to the Fontainebleau. When Ben Jr. turned 16, he was handed the keys to a Lincoln Town Car at his birthday party by none other than Meyer Lansky. He got all kinds of extravagant gifts and money from his father's pals and movie stars. And at 16, Ben Jr. wasn't just on the payroll as a figurehead. He was actually running all the sound equipment at the hotel, as well as working security for all the conventions held there. He was working hard and making great connections for his own future career. Ben Jr. was also still befriending police officers. When he turned 17, he joined the Fort Lauderdale Police Department Youth Auxiliary. Not long after that, he graduated from the Pinecrest Private School and enrolled in the University of Miami as a mass comm major. But his real interest was in law enforcement. In September of 1974, he was accepted to the Southeast Florida Institute of Criminal Justice so that he could train as an auxiliary officer. Ben Jr. went through the rigorous training required of all new cadets, and he graduated from the academy in December. Now that he was certified, basically as a reserve officer, he had a uniform and a gun, but no power to arrest. He was to serve 2 10-hour shifts a month and ride with a regular officer. But naturally, the difficult young man wasn't popular. Sometime around his 18th birthday, Ben Jr. was promoted to vice president of the Fountain Blue under his father, though he was still studying at the University of Miami. He would angrily tell any staff that called him Benji or Ben Jr. that his name was Ben. He just wanted to be called Ben. He was now 6'3" tall with a full beard, and it's understandable he wanted to be taken more seriously. And he was taking on a more important role at the hotel right when his father needed him to. Disney World in Orlando had opened 3 years earlier, and though Ben Sr. had always scoffed at the idea that it would pull money away from Miami Beach, he was proven wrong. By the mid-1970s, the Fountain Blue was getting by with convention business alone, which happened to be Ben Jr.'s forte. But Ben Sr. was in trouble. He was mortgaged up to his eyeballs, owing money everywhere, and was having cash flow issues at the Fountain Blue. By 1975, the IRS was investigating Ben Novak Sr. In late 1976, the hotel started working with the Black Tuna Gang, smuggling millions of dollars worth of marijuana from Colombia into Miami. Gang leader Robert Platzhorn, in his autobiography, would fully admit that the smuggling and distribution base for their operation was the Fountain Blue. During this time, as author John Glatt points out, it is unknown if Ben Jr. was aware of the immense drug operation going down in his father's hotel. He was extremely loyal to his father and the Fountain Blue, and with his ties to police, it is interesting to think about how much he really knew. He would never have wanted a scandal to touch their beloved hotel, but I'm not sure he would go against his father's wishes either. Now, as a grown man, Ben was coming into his own. He never had steady girlfriends, but he frequented strip clubs in Miami Beach and loved to hang out with his cop buddies. He was characterized as a natural flirt, and within a few years he did have multiple girlfriends, who he often referred to Dr. Larry Robbins, a cosmetic surgeon and friend of his dad's. Ben Jr. had a morbid interest in watching breast augmentation surgery. His unusual sexual proclivities would come back to bite him later, but this was the beginning. In 1976, he was introduced to Jill Campion. Tall and beautiful, she was an ex-showgirl and was looking for a new career. Ben became infatuated with her. He actually pulled the same stunt his father had in order to get Bernice to go out with him. Ben Jr. set up a fake job interview for Jill at the Fountain Blue. When the interview was over, he told her he couldn't hire her because the Fountain Blue had a strict policy against dating employees, and he told her he intended to date her. She later told author John Glatt that he completely swept her off her feet. She was soon taken aback at his rude behavior towards people, though. He was still obnoxious, spoiled kid Benji when around waiters, security, or bellhops, even at other hotels. Jill hated this and called him out on it. In June of 1976, the Fountain Blue owed $1.3 million in back taxes. The walls were closing in on Ben Sr. He tried desperately to raise the money to save the hotel. By November, Ben Novak Sr. had quit paying for his employees' health insurance, and paychecks were often late. One of his biggest creditors filed to put the Fountain Blue in foreclosure. Frank Sinatra stepped up and offered to buy the Fountain Blue outright, which insulted Ben Sr. The two wound up in an epic fistfight over the offer, ending with Ben Sr. throwing Sinatra out of the hotel. The singer would never perform there again. In January of 1977, right after Evel Knievel pulled the stunt, walking a tightrope between the Fountain Blue and Eden Rock Hotel, Ben Sr. was forced to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy. His mob ties stopped him from getting legitimate help, and he had run off the one chance to save the Fountain Blue from bankruptcy by cutting ties with Sinatra. He was ordered by a circuit court judge to pay $3.2 million, which would be close to $14 million today, and he couldn't come up with the money. The Fountain Blue was bought for $27 million on the court steps to Stephen Muss and the Roland International Corporation. That would be $116 million today. And Ben Sr. began moving his personal fortune to offshore accounts in his sister's name. Ben Novak Jr. had to sit back and watch as his father lost his life's work, what was supposed to be Ben Jr.'s inheritance. He was always supposed to get the keys to the kingdom one day, but it wasn't to be. But the smart young man had made many contacts in the convention industry while working at the Fountain Blue. Now he called up Amway and asked for a job organizing their conventions. They were delighted to hire him. He was very successful at Amway and traveled often for his job. He had a long engagement to Jill Campion. She was finding out that the two of them had little in common besides enjoying the nightlife. And Ben could be controlling. He expected her to dress sexy and stay very slim. She took diet pills, exercised, and tried to be the arm candy that Ben wanted. But he was constantly unfaithful to her. She told author John Glatt that he was just a liar. He would always lie to get what he wanted, she said. And though he had a good job at Amway, his mother Bernice still supported his lavish lifestyle. Bernice was very saddened when Ben Sr. lost the Fountain Blue, but she had made her own life in Fort Lauderdale. She and George Rodriguez were still a couple, though she had always refused marriage because she didn't want to lose her alimony. And Jill was becoming disenchanted and alarmed to see Ben Jr. had started using cocaine. But she married him anyway in June of 1979 in an Orthodox Jewish ceremony. The Novaks were a Jewish family, though they had never been particularly religious. Right after the wedding, Ben Jr. admitted to his wife that he was 5 years younger than he had actually claimed. But he was really 8 years younger, as she would find out, and she felt really foolish about it. She had always felt that Bernice Novak didn't like her, and thought this was the reason. But I imagine Bernice had higher expectations for her son than an ex-showgirl. Though I'm sure the age difference didn't help. And Bernice still held the purse strings. Jill found out that Ben was stalling on buying a house because Bernice didn't want Jill's name on the deed. Not long after that, she found out he had divorce papers drawn up. When he sheepishly told her he did it to show his mom so that he could buy their house, Jill was done. They were divorced in March of 1981, after less than 2 years of marriage. Jill returned her engagement ring and received a $4,000 payoff. That's almost $12,000 today, but still paltry in terms of the Novak fortune. Ben Jr. moved on quickly, buying a new house on the beach just down the road from his mother. Though they had a cold, strained relationship when he was a child, they were extremely close now. He still worked for Amway, but he was also devoting more time as a reserve officer volunteer for the Miami Beach Police Department. He wanted to make full detective, but his stutter stood in the way. It was worse under stress, and he couldn't communicate fast enough in emergency situations. But he still went out partying with his cop friends, and in August of 1983, he met a stripper at a club in Hialeah, Florida. She was young and blonde. She went by the name Sylvia and was from Ecuador. Ben gave her his business card, but she didn't think much of him at first. Until she asked some of the other girls who he was. Sylvia's real name was Narcissa Valiz Pacheco. She went by Narcy. Unlike Ben Jr., she had grown up very poor, immigrating to America slowly with the rest of her siblings, staying close to her brother Cristobal. She claimed she had been born in 1956, but author John Glatt said she has been accused of being older than she reported. She had a daughter named May Abad from a previous marriage. This didn't deter Ben. The two started a passionate affair. At one point, Narcy threatened to burn down his house on Atlantic Boulevard because she thought he was cheating. It did not bode well for how their relationship and eventual marriage would go. She was also into cocaine and the nightlife. And she was different from the women Ben was used to seeing. Though he did see strippers and showgirls, there was an unseemly quality to Narcy that everyone noticed. Though many friends still thought she was very nice and that the two were in love. Naturally, Bernice couldn't stand her. In November of 1983, Ben Novak Sr. held an auction for his personal collection of antiques, furniture, art, and other collectibles he had kept from the Fountain Blue. Bernice came to the auction and outwardly showed no regret, telling a reporter that you lose sentiment for it. But privately, it was hard watching the last of the Fountain Blue being sold off. Eventually, many items wound up in Bernice's private collection. She quietly bought up many items herself, and others were gifted. After the auction, Ben Sr., with $1 million burning a hole in his pocket, decided to invest in a new nightclub. It was to be Alcatraz-themed, with waiters wearing prison uniforms, and also accessible to the general public. He had learned a lesson from Disney taking over, and it was that he needed to cater to regular people, not just the uber-rich. Ben Jr. was doing very well. He had begun his own convention business, calling it Convention Concepts Unlimited. And like his father, his work ethic was exceptional. He was known to be tough, exacting, and an often rude businessman. He worked with hotels all over the world, and he demanded the very best and thought nothing of dressing down anyone in the staff, from hotel manager to bellhop, still behaving as the Prince of Fountain Blue. But later, people would say for all his obnoxiousness, he always paid his bills. However, he had learned a valuable trick from his father. He never signed a contract that required any payments up front. That way, he could walk away if he was unhappy. But that happened rarely. The hotels and vendors usually met his demands to avoid it. And like I said, just like a Lannister, he always paid his debts. Ben Sr.'s venture into the nightclub business failed miserably. He was living with a 30-year-old woman who had been Miss Uruguay, but his ex-wife came to see him regularly. Bernice wanted to be sure he took his medication and ate well. He was now 77 years old and had blood pressure issues. Bernice's sister Maxine told author John Glatt that her sister had always carried a torch for her ex-husband and had admitted late in life that she never should have divorced him. You have to wonder if they had stayed married, with Bernice's influence, if things would have worked out differently. Without Bernice's steadying hand, Bill Sr. fell prey to all his worst impulses. Maybe together they could have saved the Fountain Blue. In October of 1984, Ben Sr. signed over power of attorney to his son before being admitted into a nursing home after leg surgery. Ben Jr. promptly sued Miss Uruguay for a $100,000 loan and some $15,000 in jewelry she had kept. He also filed an injunction to stop her from seeing the frail old man. Ben Novak Sr. died after a stroke, then heart attack, in April of 1985, while Ben Jr. was still in court with his ex-girlfriend. Miss Uruguay had countersued for $500,000 after Ben Sr.'s death, but they reached a sudden, undisclosed agreement 2 years later in April of 1987. Ben Sr. had taken care of his ex-wife and son in his will, as well as his sister. But his adopted son Ronald, from his first marriage, whom he had turned his back on, received $1. This is so he could not contest Bill Sr.'s will. Bill Novak Sr. remained cruel towards his other ex-wife and adopted son, even in death. After his father's death, Ben Jr. changed. He finally decided to enter speech therapy to correct his stutter, and friends felt he took on personality characteristics of his more cold-hearted father. In the summer of 1987, he bought a luxury yacht worth over $500,000 with his inheritance. He docked her right outside of his beach house in Pompano, and he was still with Narcy. At this point, he had taken her to Dr. Larry Robbins for a boob job, and he loved having her pose on the boat in skimpy bikinis as he rode up and down the intercoastal. His Aunt Maxine reported that Bernice hated Narcy on first sight. She told author John Glatt, quote, "This one was no beauty, and Bernice hated her. She was so uneducated and spoke with a thick Hispanic accent. But Bernice told her sister that if she wanted to see her son, she had to put up with Narcy." Now in her mid-60s, she was close to her son and was desperate to keep that relationship. She regretted her early absentee mother years with Ben and wanted to make it up to him. Friends thought that Ben and Narcy were a love match. He seemed devoted to her, and she was different from his other girlfriends. As his aunt pointed out, she wasn't beautiful, at least not in any conventional sense. She wasn't tall and statuesque as Ben usually went for. Her dyed blonde hair and fake boobs gave her a definite air of cheapness. But Ben was in love. He put Narcy to work for his convention company, working alongside him as he built his business. Narcy converted to Judaism before they got married, hoping to win over Bernice. She agreed to sign a prenuptial agreement that meant if they divorced before 10 years of marriage, she would get nothing. After 10 years, she would receive a $65,000 settlement. That would be close to $130,000 today, but it was definitely paltry considering Ben's net worth was in the millions. The two married in December of 1990, despite Bernice's obvious misgivings. They took out a mortgage on a new luxury home almost immediately and began running his company together in earnest. May Abad, Narcy's now 16-year-old daughter, had a baby boy in 1991 and another in 1993. She would visit her mother often, although they had a very strained relationship. May would one day claim that her mother was very physically abusive to her as a child. In John Glatt's book, The Prince of Paradise, according to friends, Ben disliked his stepdaughter immensely, but he still hired her to work in his office along with his wife and mother. Bernice, who didn't like May at first, actually became close to the girl as they both hated Narcy. I think it's debatable how Ben really felt about May in the early years, but he didn't trust just anybody with his business. And in later years, he seemed to care a great deal for her. Business was good, except that Ben Novak Jr. was really gaining a reputation. He was blackballed by one big hotel chain for his obnoxious behavior. And it was here that Narcy took up the slack. She soothed vendors when she could, and she also helped him form partnerships with Latin American companies, as she was obviously fluent in Spanish. By 1994, Ben and Narcy moved to Fort Lauderdale to be closer to Bernice. They found a 6-bedroom mansion on Del Mar Place and took out a huge mortgage. Within 2 years, the Novaks bought the two adjoining lots on Del Mar, renovating one large house into new business offices. Now Bernice just had a 7-minute drive to work with her son. Friends couldn't understand why at her age she still worked that much, often 6 days a week. She made no bones about wanting to not only be around her son, but feeling the need to keep an eye on Narcy. She never trusted her daughter-in-law. She had good reason. Like a lot of people with new money, Narcy went on extravagant spending sprees. She had an immense jewelry collection and over 100 pairs of shoes. She also began lying about her past. She wanted to fit in and would tell friends that she came from a rich Ecuadorian family and then moved to New York to become a fashion designer. She started dyeing her hair a darker, less cheap-looking color. In many ways, it's hard to blame her for these lies about her past. She was trying to fit into the upper echelon of society. She was married to a multimillionaire. Now in his 40s, Ben Novak Jr. was a success. And in the late 90s, he really started showing it. He bought an island in the Bahamas and also part ownership in a private jet. However, he was so rude to the pilots that after a while, they refused to fly him. Business associates say in the beginning that Narcy was nice. She was the one who was approachable and reasonable. But she was becoming as ruthless as her husband. And she was always suspicious of him. And she had cause to be. Ben Jr. carried on many affairs, and Narcy made it her mission to catch him. They had horrendous fights, often physical, with Narcy showing up with bruises, according to a neighbor. Another friend said they chased each other down the street in cars. It was a stormy, passionate relationship, to say the least, and each giving as good as they got, according to most friends. In the summer of 1999, Bernice was convinced that Narcy was trying to poison her. She had a bottle of water in the office fridge, and after a while, when she took a drink, she thought it tasted strange. By the time she got home, she said her throat was closing up. She had long suffered from asthma, and as the event passed, that's what her doctor chalked it up to. But a friend of Ben's, Joe Gandy, claimed Narcy had also poisoned Ben. He said he went to the hospital a few times after her cooking, and Gandy himself had always refused to eat her food. He insisted that she practiced voodoo and didn't trust her. He told author John Glatt, quote, "It was a dangerous fucking situation." Ben stayed in his reserve status with the Miami Beach police and close to many officers. His friend Jim Scarberry became police chief in Hollywood, Florida in 1999. In 2002, he completed a 40-hour training program to stay in the reserves. A cop friend noticed that Ben seemed depressed. He confided that he had found out Narcy had cheated on him. They were constantly fighting and becoming more violent. But they had passed the 10-year mark in their relationship, and I guess Narcy felt free to have her own affairs now that her settlement was secure. But we will find out that it would never be enough. On Saturday, June 8th of 2002, Ben and Narcy went for dinner at a Mexican restaurant and then came home and went to bed. At 1 a.m., Ben awoke to find 3 armed men in their bedroom. As he reached for his gun on his nightstand in the dark, he distinctly heard Narcy say, "Look out, he has a gun on his nightstand." The men pinned him to the bed and put a pillow over his face as they handcuffed him with his own police handcuffs and blindfolded him. They then tied Ben to a leather chair with ropes as Narcy ran to disable the alarm system. She then allegedly told him she would cut off his penis and throw it into the canal, a la Lorena Bobbitt, as the men ransacked their home. Ben Novak was tied up for over 25 hours. They would allow him to urinate in a portable urinal on the side of his chair. Narcy took $370,000 in cash that Ben had stashed in a safe under the stairs. She took jewelry, antiques, family heirlooms, guns, important business documents, and even some of his Batman collector's items. She cleaned out her side of the closet and her toiletries from the bathroom. As she was doing this, Ben could hear her on the phone talking to an ex-boyfriend from her old strip club, who had just gotten out of jail. He also thought he heard the name of a major crime boss. He was terrified, but remained still and cooperative. On Sunday evening, 18 hours into the ordeal, he heard Narcy call her yoga instructor named Rada. She asked the woman to come help her pack up boxes. The woman came over and Ben heard them all loading boxes into trucks. After this, Narcy finally removed his blindfold and told him, quote, "If I can't have you, then no one will have you. The men that helped me will come back and finish the job. I can have you killed anytime I want. You're not dead now because I stopped them." And then she resealed his mouth with duct tape and left. Over 7 hours later, at 2:30 a.m., she called Rada again to go back to the house to move some furniture on the second floor. Narcy insisted she go, even though it was in the middle of the night. And so Rada did, and found Ben Novak tied to the chair, eyes bulging. She was horrified. She hadn't known he was tied up in the house earlier. As she untied him, he begged her not to call the police, but he did call Bernice, who came over immediately. After calling his mother, he then called his friend, a former Miami Beach police officer, who told him to call the police and get out of the house. He admitted he thought his wife was involved in the attack, but wasn't specific. He finally called the Fort Lauderdale police at close to 2 a.m. Monday morning. They promised to send someone out. And then he called his old friend Jim Scarberry, chief of Hollywood police. Though he left out Narcy's involvement when he told him what had happened, he was adamant that the police show up in unmarked cars and wanted Scarberry to use his influence with Fort Lauderdale to make it happen. They all finally agreed to Ben making a statement over the phone, so he told his story to a sergeant with the Miami Beach police. He also refused medical treatment, though he had some serious cuts and bruises. But without being able to investigate the scene, there was little the police could do. Ben Novak was obviously terrified, and they believed him. He had told the truth finally about Narcy's involvement, but their hands were tied, so all they could do was give him a case number for any future investigation. By 8 a.m. on Monday, Ben was flexing his years as a reserve officer and wanted his wife found and arrested, though he was still resisting uniformed officers coming to his house. Finally, Detective Steve Palazzo came to the Novak home in an unmarked car. He noted Ben's obvious injuries, and Ben showed him the reclining chair where he had been held. He also pointed to the safe and other places things had been stolen, but that would be hard to prove. What he did find interesting was how obvious it was that Narcy had moved out all of her belongings. Over Ben's protestations, the detective did call in one forensic agent to process the scene. He noted that Ben stayed on the phone almost the entire time, still conducting business. While detectives were at her Fort Lauderdale home, Narcy was in family court claiming she was a victim of domestic violence. She was staying at a motel and wanted her husband thrown out of their home so she could move back. Now the police had conflicting stories, but they had evidence of the attack and break-in. Tuesday morning, Ben did show up at police headquarters to make a formal statement. He repeated everything that happened and said that Narcy had orchestrated the whole thing, and then he left. By Wednesday morning, Ben called another retired Miami Beach detective named Pat Franklin for help. Franklin was now a private investigator. After the two men agreed on a $3,000 retainer, Franklin came to his house. When Franklin asked him what he wanted him to do, Ben said he wanted Narcy and his money back. Franklin was flabbergasted, but he agreed to call Narcy and try to work things out. That very afternoon, after getting a voicemail from Franklin, Narcy marched into the Fort Lauderdale police station with several boxes and bags. She said it was things she had taken in the house. And then, with no prompting, she opened up an old brown accordion file and dumped the contents onto the table. It was pornographic photographs of women with artificial limbs. She then went on to tell Detective Palazzo about their kinky sex life. She said they were both into bondage, and that is what happened that night. though she denied tying Ben to the chair. She claimed it had been a willing sexual encounter and that she didn't move her things out until the following morning when Ben was working in his office. She refused to say who helped her move, though. But she also explained the picture she had thrown on the table. She said her husband had a strange fetish about amputees. She also claimed that several years ago, Ben had hit her, breaking her nose, and that he took her to a plastic surgeon to have it fixed, and when she woke up, she also had new breast implants. This accusation has never been proven, and seems to be yet just another wild story of Narcy's. But the pictures were real, and they scared the shit out of Ben Novak when he found out. The detective later said she was completely unbelievable. He said that she was so obviously lying, but her arrogance was what was so astounding. She truly seemed to believe she would tell her lies and get away with this. No, what she knew was, once Ben found out about the pictures, he would more than likely drop the case. And he did. They went back and forth for weeks, with one agreement being that she could keep the money if she would waive all rights to any future claims once they divorced. Pat Franklin was trying to broker these deals for Ben, as the police were ready to wash their hands of it. The whole sordid affair was becoming a nuisance. They believed Ben Novak, but he in turn acted so strangely and refused to cooperate. Detective Palazzo advised him to get an attorney and file for divorce, and move on with his life. At one point, Pat Franklin met Narcy at a coffee shop, where she spewed hatred about her husband. He asked her to call Ben, mainly so he could prove to his client that he had found her, and was astonished when she got on the phone and started talking baby talk, crying, telling him she was sorry and that she loved him. She begged her husband not to send her to jail. Franklin took the phone back and told Ben that Narcy was now willing to cooperate. When he hung up, he told author John Glatt that Narcy wiped her tears and winked at him. She then gave him directions to a storage facility where all the stolen items were. She met Franklin there and unlocked the building, showing him what was in boxes. Then she asked Franklin, "Want to know what kind of sick bastard your client is?" and showed him the folder with the amputee pornography. He said not all of it was porn. Some were just pictures of amputees being fitted for prosthetic limbs. He said there were Polaroids going back to the 60s and 70s, men, women, and children. Ben would later sheepishly explain that after a group of amputees stayed at his father's hotel when he was a child, his obsession began. Franklin called Ben from the storage unit for his next instructions, and Ben asked if he had seen the pictures. Ben told him he was no longer interested in recovering the property and that Narcy was blackmailing him. Franklin handed the phone to Narcy, and they agreed that Ben would drop all criminal proceedings against her and not file for divorce. Pat Franklin was again astonished. Now he and the detectives knew that Ben was being blackmailed, but there was little they could do about it. There was a little more back and forth with the police, with Ben calling a couple of weeks later, demanding Narcy be arrested for threatening his life. But Detective Palazzo had had enough of their antics. He again told Ben there was nothing he could do, and he should just hire a divorce attorney and be done with this. Ben did file for divorce, and in the first hearing, they shocked the judge with their graphic and conflicting stories of abuse. Narcy claimed he beat her and made her have sex with other men. Ben told his story about being held hostage. It was insane. But by July 10th, they had come to a, quote, confirmation of understanding. The first line read, "Ben and Narcy wish to do everything possible to reconcile their relationship and move forward with their lives together." There were also certain financial agreements and, most importantly, privacy clauses. But the point was, after all of this, the Novaks were reuniting. And despite what was obviously blackmail on Narcy's part, for the next 7 years, they did appear to work on their marriage. Business was thriving. And though his mother and friends worried, the Novaks appeared to be solid. On Ben's 50th birthday, January 19, 2006, he made out a new will, leaving everything to Narcy. He even had plans for them to be buried together. The only codicil was that if Ben's mother survived him, meaning if he died before she did, Bernice would inherit $200,000 and half interest in the Delmar Place properties. The final note in the will was Ben stipulating that this new will would automatically void their prenuptial agreement upon his death. Whether he knew it or not, he had now signed his death warrant, and it probably never occurred to him that he was putting his mother in danger as well. Within 3 years, Ben and his mother Bernice would be brutally murdered, and the trial and scandal would rock the nation. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Please join me next week to the conclusion of the Novak murders. I had originally hoped for this to be one episode, but the backstory to the Fountain Blue, with the celebrity and mob connections, was just too juicy to leave out. But hang on to your drawers for the finale next week. Thank you to everyone who came to CrimeCon. It was an amazing event this year, and I had so much fun. If you were not able to attend, I will be at another convention this year, the inaugural True Crime Podcast Festival in Chicago on July 13th. It will be held at the Marriott downtown, right on the Magnificent Mile. This festival is strictly for true crime podcast addicts. 90 of your favorite podcasters will be there for you to meet and scoop up swag. This is a full-day event with several panel discussions, live episodes, and a huge meet and greet. To purchase tickets or learn more, go to truecrimepodcastfestival.com or look for it on social media. I hope to see you there. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. Sometimes private messages on social media get lost, so email is best, and please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.